of food? Why, we... They simply had not thought or believed it necessary. What happened to the others? To the sailing master? To the rest of the crew? I do not know. There was another boat, I believe. I do not know what happened to it. Well, my friends, you will now have decisions to make, work to do, and much hard travel. Whether you live or die will depend on you. I think not, Captain, Guadalupe said sweetly. It will depend on you. After all, Captain, we have had someone to think for us and care for us because we have been able to pay. If we ask you to do this for us, what will we have to pay you? For a moment our eyes met. Slowly I smiled. Her eyes widened and became wary. Perhaps she feared what I might say, but I merely bowed. I will do what can be done, and all I ask is passage to Europe, if, that is, you want my assistance. We can kill deer. Don Manuel was contemptuous. We are skilled at hunting. At killing, you mean? I doubt not that most of your hunting was done on game preserves, where beaters drive the game close to you to be killed. It will be different here. Here you must stalk your deer, get very close, and be sure of your shot. Then you must butcher the deer, clean it, and remove the cuts of meat you will need. You must also skin the deer, as the hide will be useful for making moccasins. Moccasins? We have our boots. How long will they last when you wade streams, struggle through swamps and bushes? And what of the women? Their slippers are suitable for ballrooms, but not for walking in the forest. Don Diego brushed aside my objections. We have the boat, Captain, which you are so kindly repairing. The boat? I shrugged. Much can happen in 400 miles. This will not be like floating upon a lake. There will be times when we must get into the water and drag the boat through shallows or over sand. We do not know what lies before us. They simply stared, then turned away, unable to grasp what had happened to them. The reality they faced was utterly grim, and they had no pattern of behavior with which to meet it. What had become, I wondered, of the old breed, of the Pizarros, of the Ponce de Leons, the Balboas, and the Alvarados? They were hard, fierce men. Many of them survivors of the Moorish Wars, bloody men in a bloody time. But in their own way, they had been ruthlessly efficient. Nothing had stopped them. These people before me were the latecomers, the courtiers, the politicians, skilled at intrigue and the use of family and political connections, who had outwitted the conquistadores at court, robbing them of the fruits of their hard-won battles and taking the profits for themselves. But the lions had made the kill, and the vultures now ate the meat. Ours was a time of radical change. The world was in ferment, yet, so it must seem, in any period of growth. For growth is ever accompanied by pain. Men had crossed the sea and ventured into new lands, discovered new things. New peoples, new religions, new gods. Luther had led a break with the church, and her vast domains had dwindled, and with it, something of her power. England, North Germany, and the Scandinavian countries had broken free and set up their own churches. Even the domains Spain claimed in the New World had been invaded by the French, English, and Dutch. Yet, there were many like Don Diego, no doubt a good man as such men went, who lifted no hand to do anything for themselves. He had been a competent governor of a small province, ruling by regulations already in force. He was a diplomat, a courtier, able enough in his own world, but helpless outside it. Like others of his kind, he despised physical labor and depended on work done by others. And now, there were no others, only Armand and the soldiers, and to these Don Diego and the others had become a burden. My years were but 28. Yet 17 of those years have been spent in bitter struggle to survive in a world of wealth and privilege, when I had neither. They did not like me, but for the time I was needed. Already I knew what a Spanish prison could be like, and I also knew that gratitude is rare, especially from such as these. When Conchita brought me coffee and a sturdy piece of ship's bread, I spoke for her ears only. Armand is a good man, I think. One of the best. She gave me a quick smile and hurried away. But now there was understanding between us, a certain sympathy. I would need all the friends I could get. I spoke to him. Armand, tonight we must watch, you and I. Felipe, he said quietly, is a strong one. Felipe was the youngest, not more than 17, I thought, but a strong-looking lad who seemed close to Armand. The others seemed a sullen, lazy lot. Wearily, I went to my place away from the group and burrowed into the sand, using a strip of bark as protection from the wind. My eyes closed. The wind stirred the leaves, and along the shore the waves rustled upon the sand. I thought of my home, and how the sea would rumble and growl among the worn black boulders, licking with hard tongues at the soft places among the rocks. Tatten Chantry, a borrowed name belonging to a man long dead. A man from where? Who had he been, that first Tatten Chantry, that stranger who died? I remembered him from my father's time, remembered the night we had lifted him from the sea, a handsome young man, scarcely more than a lad. Dead now, yet living in me, who bore his name. Had he family, friends, estates? Was he rich or poor? Brave or a coward? How had he come where we found him? A mystery then, and a mystery still. He had spoken to my father, yet what had he said beyond the name itself? Had he really said anything? I only know that my father leaned close as the pale lips struggled to speak. He died there, in our house by the sea, and when desperately I needed a name other than my own, his had come to mind. It was my name now, for better or worse. In all the years since, I had come upon no man who knew that name. Yet it haunted me then, and it haunts me still. Chapter 5. Armand awakened me with a light touch on the shoulder. My eyes opened on stars, shining through the trees. It was clouding over, but here and there a star still shone through. Slowly, my mind cleared itself of the dream stuff that lingered and brought me to reality. I was on the shores of America. I was with a party of people who were not my friends, and the future was doubtful. If there was to be any future at all. All is quiet, Armand whispered. Felipe had taken the first watch, Armand the second. Now it was my turn. We had not involved the others, as I trusted none of them. Armand and I walked together to the outer edge of camp, but he seemed reluctant to leave. He sat down near me, where we could watch along the shore and around the camp. He was silent, and I waited, knowing there was something he wanted to say. "I think we have much trouble," he said at last. "These people, they understand nothing, yet there is much that is wrong here. I feel it." "You are a Basque, Armand. Were you a fisherman?" "Sometimes. A herdsman, too. My family owned a boat, but we had sheep on the mountains, near the sea. The sea troubled me. I kept wondering what was on the other side." "So it was with me. I, too, wondered." I indicated the mainland. "I wonder what is there. Some day I shall know." We were silent, and then, choosing my words with care, I said, "Armand, I agree there is trouble here. There will be more trouble. We will be stronger if we know this. And if I know I can depend on you, and you on me. There are savages. I have seen them. We have far to travel, and to survive will be difficult. Also, there are Conchita and the Señorita Romana to consider. We must see that they are safe always. Bueno. You are sleepy now. No, Capitan. My mind is alive with thoughts. Then do you watch a little longer. I wish to look about. The boat worried me. Now that it had been repaired after a fashion, although I intended to seal the seams even more carefully with resin, I feared somebody might come upon it. It represented our best chance to escape. Without it, we should have to travel overland, a journey that would require weeks rather than days. The boat lay undisturbed when I came to it, and I stood for a few minutes, listening. Once, I thought I caught a distant sound. Unwilling to return by the same trail, on which I might encounter enemies, I followed the creek to the shore, then swung around and started up the shore, so that I might approach Armand from the sea and in plain sight. Several times, I had to walk around formidable piles of driftwood and to crawl over logs. I paused to catch my breath and looked out over the still water. I thought I heard voices, but the sounds whispered themselves away and left nothing. It was on such a night, dark, still, and with gathering clouds, that I had landed at Bristol. Behind me lay all that I had known. Before me, loneliness, uncertainty, and a life among a people who had destroyed all that I had loved. The fisherman who brought me over was a rough, kindly man. "Leave the shore," he advised, "and go inland away from it. There be many accents in England, and away from the coasts of the Irish Sea, they'll not know yours from any other. Be a quiet lad, and try to learn a trade, and you'll do well. Folks be not travellers now, you ken, and most have been no distance from their homes. They have heard of your country, but it is little enough they know. Be wary of the lads, for they can make it hard upon a stranger." That night had been dark, too, and there was little enough movement along the quay, and as I started to walk ashore, the good man handed me a bundle. "There's a change of shirt for you, lad, and a bite to eat. But dinna stop until you're far from here. Bristol is a canny town. Some would be friendly, but a sight more would not. So, get ye hence." He was a good man, but I never knew his name. I never saw him again. But here or there, time and again, I gave some friendless one a hand because of what he had done for me, a homeless lad. Truly, my life had two beginnings, the one when I was born, and the second when I walked away from that fishing boat. The delivery was made on the quay of Bristol, and I walked away into the world. Now, 17 years later, on the shores of America, I was facing another beginning, or perhaps an end. It was time I was getting back. Armand would be waiting, and now I knew the boat was safe. I went along up the shore, meeting with no more obstructions. Stepping through the last curtain of trees and brush, I emerged into the clearing. The fire was there, burned down to coals, but there was nothing more. They were gone, and I was alone again. My first instinct was to get out of sight, and I did so, stepping back quickly into the darkness under the trees. The faint reddish glow cast by the fire lit the clearing just enough for me to see that it was empty. After the first shock of discovery, I stood very still, listening. I heard nothing. Yet they had vanished, disappearing into the night as if they had never been. No, the fire was there. There might even be tracks. But I was no Red Indian to read a story from the dust. There would be tracks, of course. But how to tell those of the Spanish party from the newcomers? Or were there any newcomers? Perhaps they had left to be rid of me. Don Manuel's outright dislike had been obvious from the start, and even Don Diego had been offended by me. Inspecting the scene more carefully, I saw near the place where Guadalupe had slept something dark, seeming with a shade of red. A cloak, perhaps? Holding to the edge of darkness, I worked my way about the clearing, recovering the blanket, for such it proved to be. A blanket or a robe. I could use that. Then, near where Don Diego had slept, I saw a package that contained the food. Little enough was left, yet sufficient for a meal or two for the lot of us. No Indians had taken them then, for they would surely have wanted both the robe and the food. On the other hand, it was unlikely, if they had left to be rid of me, that the blanket and the food would be left behind, unless they were simply careless, and that I could well believe. If they were taken, how could 11 people be captured without noise? I had never been further off than 300 English yards, always within hearing of a cry or shout, and I had heard nothing. They must have left me freely and of their own accord. So be it. I picked up the robe and the package of food, which was heavier than I'd have believed, and walked back to the boat. Shoving off, I scrambled in, got up the sail, and left the creek, the clearing, and the red coals of the fire. With a light wind blowing, I moved out across the sound, if such it was. At the moment I had room in my thoughts for but one destination, the Spanish galleon. Yet I found myself scowling and perplexed. Why had they not taken the boat? And if they merely wanted to be rid of me, why not simply tell me so? I should have gone. But even had I refused, they had firearms, and I had none. It made no sense. If they had been taken by force, why was there no evidence of a struggle? There were no ships about. There had been no evidence that anyone but ourselves was in the area. Yet how much evidence had we left? Would anyone have known that we were ever present? My attention reverted to the water across which I was sailing. It was still, yet I could sense some movement, some current. Was there a river flowing from the mainland? There was a faint suggestion of grey in the eastern sky. The water had the sheen of metal, except where the shadow of some great tree fell across it. Working in along the shore, I glimpsed the dark bulk of a galleon's hull. I lowered the sail and moved in toward the shore, sculling the boat with an oar until I was close alongside. I listened, but heard no sound aboard the ship. Lines trailed from the side, evidently where the ship's boat had been lowered. Making fast to one of these, I caught another, gave it a test yank to see if it was fast at the other end, and then I went up the rope and swung to the deck. All aboard was confusion. Lines lay about, scattered clothing, even a sack that proved to be filled with food, apparently forgotten in the haste to get free of the vessel. Carefully, alert for anyone who might still be aboard, I worked my way around the ship's deck. She lay where the tide had left her, yet she seemed to lie on an even keel, and would float again, I believed, when the tide was right. All was dark and still. The vessel seemed haunted, and although I had always accounted myself a brave man, I shrank from going below. Even an empty ship is not lifeless, for it seems to stir, to creak, to yawn, even to whisper. She was a relatively small vessel, and I went aft. Dagger in hand, I entered the passage. All was still. Before me lay the great cabin, and I stepped in. The room was in turmoil. Astrolabe, sandglass, and cross staff lay upon the table along with some hastily bundled up charts. Was ever a vessel abandoned so heedlessly before? All they might have needed was left behind. There was a pistol also, and I picked it up. It was loaded. I thrust it behind my belt, just in case. Adjoining this room was another, and much smaller one. A faint perfume lingered. Without doubt, the cabin of Guadalupe Romana. Then I saw an incongruous touch, In a corner of the room was a small chest. It must have belonged to her. The top was thrown back, as though its contents had been ripped from inside. No woman would have been likely to leave it so, for these chests were used to store keepsakes, the little things a woman treasures. No, there was but one likely explanation. After Guadalupe Romana had left the cabin, somebody had entered here and searched. For what? I took another look around. I would return later. When I came again to the deck, there was a faint pink in the sky. I went forward. The vessel was lightly aground, but the tide would float her free. Perhaps she would work free anyway, if there was a little current here, some movement of the water. The vessel was simply abandoned, deserted by passengers and crew. Fair game for any who came. And I was here. The sack of foodstuffs found upon the deck, I dropped into my boat. I also collected some further gear, a coil of line, some canvas. I found a cask of powder, a bullet mould, several bars of lead, 3 muskets, 2 more pistols. I returned to the cabin of the Señorita Romana and carefully repacked the small chest. Then I gathered what I could find of clothing and packed that into another leather chest. As I kicked aside some of the fallen bedclothing that lay in my path, I heard a faint tinkle. I looked down and saw a small medallion of peculiar shape and design. Putting down the chest, I took it up. On one side was some odd lettering, or what seemed to be lettering, of a kind I had not seen before. On the other was a strange design of twisting lines and half circles. It was not a coin, but it seemed to be very, very old and worn. I dropped it into a small bag I carried in my belt. On deck, I completed loading the boat, going to the pantry for further food. It was broad daylight by the time the last items were aboard, and I stood by the bulwark, looking all about me. Nowhere was there any sign of life, save the occasional flocks of birds that flew over, or a fish jumping out on the sound. Lying close in to shore as she was, there was small chance of the boat being seen. Again I went below, but this time into the hold. There I saw a full cargo, casks, bales, and bundles of I knew not what, but not, I knew, what I sought. Suddenly I came to a door, heavily timbered and locked. For a moment I looked at the door. I looked at the lock. It made me smile. To one who had wandered the high roads of England, France, Spain, and Italy, as I had, locks were no mystery. In less than a minute, I had picked the lock and opened the door into the room. There were several stacks of something covered with sheets of canvas. I lifted one. Silver bars. I hefted the nearest. No less than 30 pounds. Stepping back, I judged the sizes of the piles. 8, perhaps 10 tons of silver. The silver was neatly piled, with cross beams of oak to hold it in place so the cargo would not shift. Beyond, in a smaller cabin or locker, was what I hoped to find. Not one chest, but 3. I tested the weight. Heavy, very heavy. Yet I was a strong man, and such weights had once been common enough for me. One by one, I carried them into the main hold, then closed the door and locked it once again. Back on deck, I rigged tackle over the hold and hoisted the boxes, one at a time, to the deck. Then I lowered them into the boat. Although the boat could carry 20 men and their gear, she was well down in the water when I loosed my painter and shoved off. I saw the name on the galleon's stern. San Juan de Dios. My heart was beating heavily, and I was perspiring. But not from the work I had done. I had no need to examine the chests. I knew what was in them. If I could only get away with what I had here beside me, there need never again be hunger, thirst, or cold. I would have my fortune. Chapter 6. Holding as close to the shore as was practical, I rowed the heavily laden boat westward. Along the shores were great stands of cypress and swamp gum, festooned with Spanish moss. Behind the clumps of trees in some places lay swamp or shrub bogs, covered with evergreens, all low-growing. Somewhere I had to find solid ground, or a river leading inland, up which I might take my cargo. Now that I had a boat loaded with supplies and wealth, I was a worried man, for fear that I might come upon Indians, or even pirates, many of whom haunted these shores, lying in wait for Spanish vessels. As I moved, I kept alert for whatever might come, yet a part of my mind worried over yet another question. There had been but little water in the ship's hold that I could see, and not much damage that was visible. Surely not enough damage to cause the passengers to abandon ship in such a quiet sound. Something, or somebody, must have frightened them. There could be but one reason I could think of. They wanted the ship's treasure. If such was the case, then I could expect them to come searching for the ship, and soon. The wind was rising, yet I hesitated to hoist my sail. With the sail I could move faster and easier, but my boat would be more visible. I worked the boat among some small islands, most of which were strips of sand and mud, covered with low growth. Many of these, I suspected, would be temporary, to be flooded out by the next big Atlantic storm, with heavy rain or snow. Yet now they offered concealment, and a sort of backwater, where I might feel safe a moment. My eye caught a break in the end of an islet near me. I moved up around the end of the island to see that it was cleft from the end almost to the middle. The cleft was walled to the water's edge by a thick growth of willows and swamp gum. Deliberately, I trailed one oar and pulled on the other, turning the bow of my boat into the cleft. The green walls closed about me. Catching at branches, I eased the boat to a stop before it hit into the mud at the bank. Then I made it fast to a small tree. Now, unless someone came right past the end of the islet, I was hidden, lost to the world. Filling a shot pouch and powder horn, I checked the loads on another pistol and a musket, and stepped ashore. Now to find a place to hide my fortune, if such a place could be had. Hidden well, and above high water level. Catching hold of a slim tree, I swung myself ashore. The islet was no more than 100 yards long, perhaps less, and like its neighbours it was covered with low brush and small trees. Near the upper end of the islet there was a mass of driftwood, a tangle of roots, branches, and bark, that had floated down the river and piled up here. Several of the logs offered a convenient bridge to the next little islet, and from there it might not be difficult to get ashore. I returned to the boat and found bread and cheese, enough to make a meal. Slipping a few squares of ship's biscuit into my shirt, I crossed to the neighbouring islet, then waded through the shallow water to the shore. For an hour I walked steadily inland, or what I believed was inland, for with the number of watercourses, streams, and swamps, it was impossible to be sure. Yet finally I came to higher ground, and a thick stand of cedar giving way to pine. Turning to look back, I found, only a few steps from me, an edge of the forest, with a view of the sound from which I had come. At first I saw nothing. And then I did. The ship was moving. She had somehow worked herself free of her position, and the wind and tide were moving her inland toward the shore. Slowly, gracefully, she moved. She was down in the water all right, but not very much, and the tide, coupled with the rising wind, was moving her along. I watched her, thinking of those tons of silver, yet I had no way of moving them. Still, watching her, my eyes caught something else. Something closer to me. I shifted my gaze. Had I been mistaken? There was nothing. Yet, even as I turned away, my eyes caught the movement again. A moment I waited, looking. Faint, Yes, it was smoke. Only a suggestion, and it was some distance off, perhaps 2 or 3 miles, but there was smoke. Savages? Perhaps. And perhaps, too, it was my former Spanish acquaintances. My excitement caused me to consider. After all, what were they to me? Had they not left me, abandoning me to my fate? They were no business of mine, none at all. What I imagined was a mystery about Guadalupe Romana was nothing to be concerned about. She was to be married. She was probably looking forward to it with some excitement, even though she did not know the man. And she had protectors, of a sort. Yet, I could not completely convince myself. Suddenly I became aware that I was walking. I was already headed toward that smoke. "Feet," I said aloud, "you lead me to trouble. For as surely as I go back to them, there will be strife." Yet, when I stopped to think of it, when had I not known trouble? And was not struggle the law of growth? It took me more than an hour to get close to the smoke, though it was little more than a mile away. The camp was on high ground among the pines, and I could see their fire a good 100 yards before I was expecting it. They were less than careful, which did not surprise me, but they had company, which did. I paused behind some brush and looked them over carefully. At the distance, I could only make out the fire, some smoke, and several more people than I had expected to see. I had started to approach closer for a better look when I heard, close by me, a faint chink of metal on metal. Instantly, I was immobile, my hand on my sword. The brush was thick, so I squatted to peer through the stems where there might be fewer leaves. I found myself looking into a pair of squinting brown eyes, belonging to a man who was crouching not 6 feet from me. "Captain Tatton Chantry," I said. "And may I be of service?" He blinked. He had the advantage of me, for his blade was in his hand. "That you may," he replied grimly. "I'd like to know who the bloody hell you are, and what you think you're doing." "Merely a passing wayfarer," I replied cheerfully. "Left ashore by the ship the Good Catherine when we were attacked by Indians." "And you?" "The Catherine was a ship, you say? And not a woman? 'Twould not be the first time a man had been left high and dry by a woman." "It was indeed a ship, and carrying all I owned, it was. Gone now, and here I stand." "And here you squat, you should say, because that's what you're a-doin'. I am wondering if your story's a true one. Do you question my word? If so, stand up like a man, call me a liar, then make your peace with the Lord." "Ah, you're the cocky one, aren't you? Ready to fight, are you? Well, I am not. Unless cornered, that is, or there's gold in it, I'd fight then. Once I'd have fought for a woman, but no more. They aren't worth it. Fought for 'em often, I did, until once the two of us stood to our weapons nigh an hour with no benefit to one side or the other. And when we stopped to draw breath, be damned if the woman had not gone off with a man, not half of either of us. It shows a man. It shows him. You have the advantage of me. There's a woman by the fire yonder I'd fight for. Now, tomorrow, or any day. Ah, that fire. That woman. Well, you'd have to fight, my friend, but you'd lose. That man yonder who stands beside that fire is a swordsman. He's one of the best." "Only one of the best? Then perhaps we shall see what best is, where he comes from." The man slowly stood up and unlimbered himself. He was a good 2 inches taller than I, and perhaps 20 pounds less in weight. He had a long, haggard face and half an ear missing. His hands were extraordinarily large, and his feet as well. He was clad in rags, the merest remnants of clothing. "Who am I?" you ask. "Just a poor sailor man who's been ashore these past months, dodging redskins and keeping a weather eye out for a ship, any kind of ship, to take me back where there's Christian folk. What about those people? A bad lot, a mighty bad lot, if you'll be taking my word for it. Had he seen my boat? If he had not, I was wishful that he would not. Yet such a one as this might easily stumble upon it, where a larger party would have small chance of doing so. You've been down to their camp? That I have not, nor shall I, for they're a bad lot, as I've said. They're folk to fight shy of. As briefly as possible, I explained how I came to be here, and what my intentions were, as far as I knew them. I said at the last, it is a ship I want too, and a means to get back to England. But there's a girl yonder that worries me. I think she is in trouble. Ah! It's the youth in you speaking. In trouble, is she? I'll warrant if she's not, she will be. Trouble goes with women, walks hand in hand with them, and he who goes among them shall expect nothing else. I believe she'd like to be free of them, I said, irritated. Did she tell you that? Is it her husband she'd be free of? Well, I'm not surprised. The trouble with women is, they're always looking over the fence where the grass is greener. She would not be looking at me then, I replied, for I've nothing more than what you see. I'd put by a bit, and made a venture with the good Catherine, and it is lost to me. Gone. Aye, you'll see nothing more of that cargo. The good captain of the good Catherine will add your portion to his and grow the fatter for it. He glanced at me shrewdly. The girl, is it? The Injun girl, or that proud and devil-be-damned Spanish lass? It is the Señorita Guadalupe Romana, I said, with what I hoped was dignity. She is a lady and a lovely one. Oh, I doubt it not. Them's the worst kind. She'll invite you to come forward in every way a woman has, then scream if you put a hand on her. I know the kind. You do not know her, I replied stubbornly, but we'll get nothing done standing here. Go you about whatever it is you do. I am going to see if that girl needs assistance. Now what would I have to do in this godforsaken place besides saving my skin? What, I ask? You'll not be rid of me so easy as that. I think you've a means to a ship, so I'll stand hard by. And I'll listen to your troubles. I'll share whatever it is you eat. I'll drink at your wake. But I'll have nothing to do with your fancy women. He turned his head, looking for all the world like a big bird, and then shook his open hand at me. Don't get me wrong. I like a woman as well as the next man. But find them. Have your hour with them. And leave them. That's what I say. If they speak of love, put your hand on your poke and keep it there. If they start worrying about you catching cold, or not eating right, or drinking too much, catch the first vessel out of port. Believe me, when it comes to women, I know them. Oh, do I know them. My gesture indicated his sword. Can you use that thing? Or is it just hung there for show? Show, is it? I can use it. Well enough, I can use it. I fought my battles by sea and land and used every sort of weapon, and I am alive to see this day. I've been a rich man twice, left for dead once, twice a slave, and many times a prisoner. I know when to fight and when to run, and run I will if the time is not right or the number's too great. He glanced at me. Don't look for me to be a hero. That I am not. I will fight as long as it looks like winning, and if there's a bit to be had, I'll fight the harder, and longer too. Do you have a name then? I've told you mine. Captain Tatten Chantry, he says. Now there's a name. It has a sound to it, all right. Well, mine does too, for I'm known as Silliman Turley. All right, Turley. Come along with me if you wish, but if trouble comes, you stand to that sword, or I'll have no part of you. Well now, Captain he says, and Captain he acts. So be it. You lead and I will follow, and you'll not find me lacking. But if you fail me, I'll be off. And you can lay to that. My attention had been on the camp as we talked. We were some distance off, and had kept our voices low. But I didn't want them to know we were about, until I had some idea of what was happening. It was clear enough what my intentions should now be. To find a ship, or some way in which to return to England, and open proceedings that would establish my claim to some of the profit from the voyage of the Good Catherine. A thought occurred to me. Turley, how long have you been here? He shrugged. 2 years, I think. A man loses count of time when the days are alike, and he has no need to be anywhere at a certain moment. It was a late summer when I came ashore, and there was a winter, then another winter. No trouble with Indians. I, with some of them. Mostly I keep shy of them. He pointed. I've a place in the swamp, deep inside. Moving with infinite care, we edged closer to the camp. Turley was like a ghost in the woods. His body seemed to glide between leaves and branches, or under them, stirring scarcely a leaf in the passing. I was more clumsy, yet watching him, I learned to do better. Soon he paused, lifting a hand. There were voices, a faint smell of smoke. First I saw Armand and Felipe. They stood together, off to one side. Don Diego and Guadalupe Romana stood together. Don Manuel sat on a log not far from them. A large man was facing them. A huge, enormously fat man, but one who moved with that curious ability some fat men seem to possess. Do not repeat to me this fiction, this romance. I do not believe in your mysterious Englishman. I think he is a lie, but no matter. Tell me this only. Where is the San Juan de Dios? I repeat, Don Diego replied with dignity. The galleon was sinking. Don Manuel acted quickly, getting us into the boat and away. Without him, we all might have been lost. Ah, yes, Don Manuel. Very heroic, no doubt. But do you not ask yourselves why he hurried you? Was the vessel actually sinking? Was he saving your lives, or merely getting you off the ship and away? Of course she was sinking, Don Diego protested. She was lying well over when we made the deck. I acted to save them, Don Manuel replied coolly. As for the San Juan de Dios, she undoubtedly lies on the bottom of the sea. Ha! The big man turned in such a way that I could see a part of his face. It was a bearded but brutal face, the face of a strong, ruthless man, but an intelligent one, or such was my immediate estimate. Very neat, very tidy indeed. And does the distinguished Don Diego know that your own vessel, the Santiago, is soon to sail up this coast? Is that true? Don Diego spoke in a lower voice, and we could scarcely hear the words. Don Manuel shrugged. But of course, it was to sail to Florida, then to come along up the coast to spy out the presence of any French settlements, or any English settlements, for that matter. For our people in England tell us that Sir Walter Raleigh is planning some such venture. It is a service to the king. And you? The big man spoke with sarcasm. Were not you to be here to meet your vessel? I would have been in Spain, Don Manuel replied. I took passage on the San Juan de Dios, expecting it would take me to Spain. But you are not in Spain, Don Manuel, the big man said. You are here. A galleon loaded with gold is near here, and your rescue ship is coming. How very convenient, Don Manuel. Chapter 7. For a moment, there was silence in the camp. Then the large man turned abruptly away from the dons and gestured to two armed men who stood nearby. They are not to leave camp. They will be guarded every minute, and if either escapes... The guards obviously understood the uncompleted sentence. Ignoring Guadalupe, the fat man strode across the camp to confront Armand and Felipe. "This Englishman? You spoke with him?"
"We did."
"Who was he? What was he?"
"A man cast away.
He had come ashore for water. His party was attacked, and he was abandoned when the others fled."
"Ah, yes. So he said..." He paused, as if thinking.
"This captain, what sort of man was he?"
"A gentleman.
And unless I mistake not, a swordsman."
"You mean he was a man who carried a sword?"
The big man's tone was contemptuous.
"I mean, a swordsman.
He had the movements and the manner, the style, if I might say so."
"Ah, you speak as one who knows. Do you?"
"I do. I worked in the armory at Toledo. I was a maker of swords, and I have observed many swordsmen. I have seen the best."
"A swordsman? All right, I accept it. And a captain, too.
A captain of what?"
"I do not know."
"What has become of him?"
"He went for a walk along the shore. I believe he wished to see if any ships were about. He did not come back."
"Any ships? Or one particular galleon?"
"Who knows?"
"So he did not return. Did he join others hidden nearby, perhaps? Did he seem interested in the galleon?"
"No." Armand lied.
"He knew only that we had escaped from a sinking ship. Nothing more." The large man turned sharply on Felipe. "Is that true?"
"I believe so.
He seemed interested only in getting something to eat.
He was hungry, I think."
"Why do you think so?"
"I have been hungry, senor. I observed his attention to the fire where the food was, and how he ate. He was hungry, senor, even though he claimed this land."
Felipe waved a hand.
"As his estate."
The big man changed the subject. "The San Juan de Dios, where is she now?"
"I do not know. We were ordered to the boats. When I looked back, she was down in the water. But where or when she sank, who knows?"
The large man, whoever he was, seemed to know what he was about. That worried me. He was no man to trifle with, and it was obvious his sources of information were excellent. Yet where was his ship, if ship he had? Now he was giving orders to several men, and they were moving out.
"We'd better get shy of this place,"
Turley whispered.
"They're coming for a look around, I'm thinking."
We moved back, taking our time and trying to make no sound or movement. From the slight rise from which we had first viewed the camp, I glanced back. The original Spaniards were all there, but there were a number of other men moving about. There must now be at least 20 in all. There was something disturbing about the large man, something that made me feel that I'd seen him before. Another strange man, a man lying on the ground with his back to us, had also seemed familiar. Suddenly we heard the big man speak again. His voice was loud.
"No man or woman is to leave this camp but by my order. Do you understand that? He or she who tries to leave will die, and I do not exaggerate. I don't care that," he snapped his fingers, "for any of you."
Don Diego replied, his voice strong and clear.
"Señor, if harm comes to anyone here, I will see that you hang for it, and your comrades will hang beside you."
He paused then and said,
"Do you remember who I am, señor?"
The large man bowed with a sweep of his hat. "Who does not, Don Diego? But let me remind you that the seas are wide, and a man with a ship can go where he will. And I shall go where not even you can follow, and where the might of Spain is less than a whisper in the night. I will do what I please, Don Diego, and when it pleases me to do so, I shall slit your noble gullet with my own hand, and feed what remains to the fish. Do you understand me, Don Diego? You are nothing here.
Nothing."
I have the power now, and I alone.
We moved away, finding our way back to a cedar-clad knoll where the waters of the Sound could be seen, and much of the area around. There was now no sign of the San Juan de Dios. Had she sunk at last, or found some other place to rest, until another tide floated her free? Search as I might, I could see nothing of her. We went down off the knoll and into a deeper thicket of cedar. There we found a place where the earth had been hollowed, perhaps by some bear, long ago, at the base of a cedar, but close against the trunk, where it was covered by thick branches. There was room for two there, and we took shelter. From the packet inside my shirt, I took some ship's biscuit and shared it with Turley. Night was shading down, and we settled ourselves for sleep. Turley, with the ease of his years in the woods, was soon asleep, but I lay long awake, disturbed by memories of my youth. Why they had suddenly come upon me now, I could not guess. But lying back and looking up at the cedar, enjoying the pleasant smell of the crushed needles, my mind strayed back to my boyhood. My father had been a bookish man, quiet in manner and gentle of voice. He loved to walk the lonely beaches as I did, and to climb among the rocks. Often when resting, he told me stories of the Milesians who had come to Ireland from Spain, long, long ago, and how the Irish were then called Scots from a Milesian queen named Scotta. She had been a daughter of Pharaoh, ruler of Egypt. He told me tales of Conn of the Hundred Battles, and of the old kings who ruled from Tara, and of the Druids who had been their teachers and advisers. He told me the story of how the Danes had settled Dublin. In Gaelic, it was Dublin, or the Black Pond. One morning, he took up his stick and said, "Come, lad, I've a thing to show you." And he took me out along the shore and up among the rocks to a high place where the ground was suddenly flat, rimmed all around with the ruins of an ancient wall. "It was a castle once," he said, "a fortress of a sort. It commanded," he pointed the path, "away up from the sea. Yet it was a rare raider who came this way. Most often, they came from the east coast and attacked the people who lived there. Only now are we in grave danger here." "We are? You bear an old name, my son, as do I. Our name is a symbol, and so it has been for many, many years. Yes, one day they will come. Somehow, we must get you safely away." "I want to stay with you. I can fight." I said this with more hope than honesty, for although I had learned to ride and to shoot, to fence and to duel with the quarterstaff, I had never fought except with my fists against the village boys. "No, you must not fight. You must escape, and then one day you will come back here and claim what is truly yours. The name must continue to live, even though it must live in hiding. This castle," he gestured about him, "was built of huge timbers once. Twice it was destroyed, and then it was built of stone. Again it was destroyed, and again rebuilt. The last time it lay as you now see it. But if the stones are down and the walls are gone, we still live. You must come back here, my son. Someday, you must come back." A few short years later, he was dead, killed by the invader, and I was a fugitive, hunted through all the counties of Ireland. My mother's people were of the Tuatha De Danann, who ruled Ireland before the coming of the Milesians, a wise and strong people, noted for their arts and knowledge. So my people were doubly old in the land, and my name was known throughout Ireland. Hard had been the years of my flight, hard the very days after I landed in England. The village folk stared at me as I walked through, and the dogs barked and ran, snapping at my heels. But frightened though I was, I did not turn, but walked on through the village and away into the land. That night, I slept in a corner of a stone wall, and in the morning started on.
The bit of food I'd brought from the boat lasted me through the day. Twice I turned down lonely lanes, and then reached a muddy road and passed an inn. I'd a bit of money, and my belly demanded attention. Yet I hesitated for fear of stirring curiosity at a lad going his way alone. Most inns would not wish my custom, yet my hunger was such that I turned from the road and went up to the door. It was an impressive place, with timbered galleries, a courtyard, and stables. I went into the common room, glancing into the kitchen as I passed the door. It seemed to glitter with copper kettles, brass candlesticks, and a row of pothooks at the wide fireplace. There were evidently few travellers on the road, for there were but four men within the common room. One of them, a stout, older man with grey hair, who shot me a quick, appraising look out of kindly blue eyes. A pair of men who might be locals were sharing a bench, and drinking to each other from the same tankard, as the custom was. The fourth man was slim and handsome, a man with prematurely white hair and lean features that might have been carved from marble, so white they were, and so expressionless, save for the eyes. The eyes were very large, and almost black. He had glanced up when I came in, then paid me no attention. I had slept in my clothes, and they were rumpled. I must not have looked well, for the tavern keeper, a burly, brusque sort of man, came forward.
"All right, we'll have no—"
Young I might be, but I'd not been born to a castle for nothing.
"Ale,"
I replied coolly, standing my ground. "And a bit of bread and cheese. If you have a slice or two of beef, so much the better." I pointed toward an empty table near the stout old man. "I'll have it there," I said, and, ignoring him, I walked over and seated myself. He hesitated, taken aback by my manner. So unlike a lad from the lanes or the farms. He started to speak. "I have little time," I told him. "I am expected." He left the room, and a maid came quickly, throwing me a curious glance. She hit the table a swipe with a cloth, and then put down a tankard of ale.
"A moment, sir, and we'll be having the rest."
Then, under her breath, she whispered,
"If you've naught to pay with, better run now. He's a fierce, hard man."
Placing a gold coin on the table, I heard her gasp. In a moment the tavern keeper was there, and he reached for the coin.
"Leave it," I said.
"When I've eaten, you can take of it what is necessary." The white-haired man in the blue coat had turned his head and was regarding me. The last I wished was to draw attention to myself, but neither did I intend to be robbed or bullied. It was little enough I had, and each penny would be needed. The tavern keeper turned from the table, his face and neck flushed with angry blood. He liked it not, being spoken to so by a mere lad, and had there not been others present, it might have gone hard with me. Yet he was worried too, for my manner told him what sort of person I was, and he wanted no trouble. The food came soon, and I ate slowly, taking my time. Every morsel of food tasted good, and the ale did likewise. After a bit, the old man got up, bobbed his head in a brief nod to me, and went out. A moment later, I heard the creaking of a cart and glimpsed them past the door, a covered cart drawn by a donkey. The old man walked alongside, and a big dog trotted behind. The tavern keeper came in again.
"That'll be sixpence," he said.
The man with the white hair was gazing out the door. "Fourpence," he said, absently. The tavern keeper started, glancing swiftly at the white-haired man.
"It'll be sixpence,"
he said under his breath. "Fourpence," the white-haired man repeated. The tavern keeper took up the gold coin and left the room. I waited and waited, but the white-haired man waited also. Finally, my host returned and placed a stack of coins upon the table.
"Count them,"
the man with the white hair said.
"Is it that you think I'd cheat the lad?"
"You would," the man said. He got to his feet. He was not a tall man, but lean and well set up. My coins were a half crown short. I held out my hand.